For a long time, Australia has been discussing how to acknowledge Indigenous Australians in the Constitution. In 1999, there was the failed referendum on acknowledging Australia's First Peoples in the preamble. What has become clear over time is that a symbolic gesture in the Constitution was not what Indigenous Australians wanted. An expert panel was formed to look at the issue under the Gillard government, but the government changed before the recommendations were responded to. The Referendum Council was established in 2015, and its work culminated in the Uluru Statement, handed down in 2017, only to have the government reject the council's recommendations. 1 year on, the question needs to be asked, is this going to be just another report the government commissions and shelves, or is there still life left in it? My next guest was on the Referendum Council, and I'm pleased to welcome her to the program, Megan Davis, who's a Cobble Cobble woman from Queensland, Pro-Vice-Chancellor, Indigenous, and Professor of Law at the University of New South Wales. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks for having me, Tracy.
When you were appointed to the council, what was the task that was given to you?
Yeah, so it was a pretty specific task. Up until the referendum council, we really had a number of, I suppose, key recommendations on the table from the expert panel. But one thing that happened was a comprehensive engagement with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people about what they regarded as meaningful recognition. So the Referendum Council kind of, you know, tasked themselves with that particular job, because it's really important in any liberal democracy where you're undertaking a recognition project, so to speak, that the group that you're purporting to recognise agree with the recommendations or the reforms that are on the table. Because if they don't, then it's not recognition. So that was the key, I suppose, job of the Referendum Council.
And so what ensued was basically unprecedented, a dialogue that took place across the nation. How were those conversations organised, and who was invited to take part?
Yeah, so once the Referendum Council decided that that was our key job, was to just get an indication from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people what they thought recognition should look like, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander members of the council got together then to design a dialogue process with our regions, with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in 13 regions across the country. What we wanted to do was have like a conversation about the constitution. We went out to communities at a point where there was really serious consultation fatigue. And a lot of cynicism, and a lot of, I suppose, voicelessness and powerlessness, was very palpable in a lot of communities because of the impact of, the Indigenous Advancement Strategy, which was a Commonwealth policy introduced in 2014. So we developed a structured conversation, a dialogue with communities that involved civics education, and the key recommendations for recognition that the opposition leader agreed to and the Prime Minister agreed to. And so that went over 3 days. And at the end of that process, we adopted a record of meeting, which was a record of what communities spoke about and what they preferenced as the priority for reform in their regions. And that work culminated with a national constitutional convention, which was held at famously at Yallara, and with the final adoption of those reforms at Mutitjulu at the foot of Uluru.
We'll get to that in a moment, but I just want to work out how you went about getting acceptance of one statement, if you like, because, you know, we talk about these communities, don't we? Any community, doesn't matter which one you talk about, which is made up of a whole lot of different people with a whole lot of different perspectives. And I imagine the Indigenous community is no different from one side of the country to the other. So did you find there was a lot of overlap in what they were each looking for, or were they quite diverse things that people were voicing?
No, there was a lot of commonality. The differences emerge in relation to different legal reforms, because of course the territories, the ACT and the Northern Territory, fall under a particular power in the Constitution, Section 122, but the other states don't. There are also different, you know, jurisdictions relating, or should I say land rights regimes in different jurisdictions. So there are little nuances, but by and large, everybody preferenced the same way. The voice to Parliament was ranked as the priority for our communities at the moment. Then, of course, treaty making or agreement making, that's a mainstay aspiration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and then this notion of truth-telling. So really the truth component, I suppose, was the most unexpected. We didn't go out with a mandate from the Prime Minister and opposition leader to take a truth commission out, but in the first day of the structured dialogue, Australian history emerged as the first thing people wanted to talk about. So the first thing people wanted to get off their chests was the fact that Australians didn't perhaps understand or know much about Aboriginal history, and all of the regions, all of them, felt that that was absolutely inextricably linked to the reform, that if Australians could understand what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people had been through historically, then it would be easier for them to understand why the reforms were so important.
So if you were giving us a summary of what the Uluru Statement says, what are the three major components?
So the Uluru Statement's actually about 18 pages long. The most famous component of that is the first page, which is the Uluru Statement from the Heart. But the rest of the document captures, in essence, the dialogue. So there's three components effectively to it. The first part is, of course, the Uluru Statement from the Heart. The second is what we call my story, or our story, sorry, not my story, our story. And what that is as we went around the country and people spoke on that first day about history and about truth-telling, what emerged was a really fascinating, common, historical story about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia. So everybody followed the same kind of trajectory. They spoke about pre-contact, then first contact. Or the invasion is what we called it. Then they spoke about the conciliation phase, a very early short period of attempts to create friendly relations between the two parties. And then the massacres, so the frontier wars or the killing times, which then moved into that, you know, early federation period of the protection era. So those statutory regimes set up created a system of compulsory racial segregation in Australia, you know, right up to the assimilation policies and then self-determination. So the stories followed a very similar track in every dialogue. And so that's captured in a very moving and powerful history, which, you know, not enough people are reading in terms of the Uluru Statement. You know, it's a really powerful and beautiful story. And then the third component is the reforms. So in it, we show what the assessment principles were that all of the dialogues adopted in terms of determining what's a priority, and then the three key recommendations for reform and the justification for that. So the notion of a constitutionally enshrined voice to a parliament, secondly, a Makarrata Commission or agreement-making commission, and thirdly, the process of truth-telling. So that's that those three components, voice, treaty, truth, were really the key reforms. But that full 18-page Uluru document really is needs to be read in its entirety to understand, you know, the motivation and reasoning behind it.
It was you that read the Uluru Statement from the Heart at Mutitjulu. Was the feeling at that moment that this was something historic?
I can't remember. We weren't going to read it again out at the Rock, and then, you know, Noel and Pat were like, get up and read it. So I was kind of not prepared, but I'd read it obviously at Yulara, where it was adopted unanimously immediately. And a lot of people had travelled home at that point, so it wasn't as big as the opening ceremony. The closing ceremony was very, what was really special about it was that it was very intimate and very powerful. All the media had gone. It was really, really intimate for all of those Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who participated in that process. So, I suppose in some ways it felt historic in that Never before had we seen all of the key cultural authority from around the country come together and adopt unanimously, you know, and with consensus, those reforms. I think that was very overwhelming, the fact that we were all on the same page.
And then in November last year, after the government's rejection of the statement, you called the act cruel, hard-hearted and callous. Do you still...
Oh, did I?
Yeah. Have you softened from that position?
Sounds harsh. Look, it was cruel. I mean, you know, as a constitutional lawyer, I know that it's difficult to get reform. So we didn't know how it would travel. I suppose it was quite ruthless the way in which it was done. It was leaked to the Courier Mail, and you know, people found out that way. People ringing each other at midnight on a Monday night saying, you know, they're dumping it. No one had communicated to anyone of significance in the kind of Uluru process what they were going to do. And, of course, as a public lawyer, I found the justifications really unfair. They're not accurate. The idea that somehow these reforms are inconsistent with Australia's liberal democratic system or our, you know, constitutional system was just complete and utter nonsense. But what we were most upset about, and I think the word callous refers to this, is the young people that we brought along on the journey. I write in the most recent quarterly essay about having to, that day, having to, look after so many young people who we brought along the journey to expose them to Aboriginal leadership and constitutional law and law reform. And they were all in tears, like their hearts were broken. And I think for senior constitutional lawyers, one of our greatest concerns is that, you know, the downstream risk of this is that another generation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people lose faith in our democratic system to change. And that's disappointing because, well, it's not disappointing, it's really worrying for us because the system is built to change and it can change. And we haven't given up on that.
We know that, you know, the Attorney General gave his advice and the government had a variety of concerns, which then stemmed out into the public domain. And I guess the biggest question really focused on the Indigenous voice to Parliament and what sort of authority it was going to have, how it would actually work in practice. And I think there was a lot of disinformation around that time. But can you explain how you thought it would work and how it does fit into our constitutional law, how it could fit into that in a best practice sense?
Yeah, look, the voice to Parliament is something that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been advocating for since like the 1840s. And there's a number of different ways that that can take form. So in the dialogues, we spoke about things like, you know, Indigenous parliaments, like what you see in Norway and Finland and Sweden. Each of them have varying degrees of, policy making autonomy, differing degrees of power. None of them are regarded as a kind of third chamber or a separate parliament. They're called the Sami parliament, but they have decision making in particular areas. There's other ways of doing it, like in New Zealand with reserved seats or designated parliamentary seats. But reserve seats, we were never given permission to take that out. Well, we were given permission. So the Prime Minister did say yes, and so did the opposition leader, to the voice to the Parliament going out to the regional dialogues, was a kind of, rough sketch that this would be a body that would contribute to policy making and decision making at a Commonwealth level on matters that relate to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's lives. One of the things that, and then what we did in the dialogues then, we went through about 15 to 20 different countries around the world that have similar kinds of decision-making structures. And we got some basic contours from the regional dialogues about what this voice would look like. So one of the primary things that the dialogues thought would be a very powerful thing for this voice to Parliament to do would be that the institution would monitor laws that were passed under the race power, section 5126 of the Constitution, and also section 122, the territory's plenary power, under the Constitution, which was the power that led to the passing of the Northern Territory Emergency Response, the Northern Territory Intervention suite of legislation. So that was a really important development in terms of what form the voice of the Parliament would take, because as I've said on multiple occasions, not a single constitutional lawyer had come up with this structure or this idea that rather than changing the race power, the voice to Parliament would actually play a role in policing the race power, so you wouldn't have to amend it. And that was an innovation that came entirely from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. A very important, I think, constitutional innovation. So in terms of the form, what we've done or what the Referendum Council did was a very common constitutional technique in the world known as a decision to defer. And what that means is what we did was, with a nod to parliamentary sovereignty, say, this is the general power in relation to the reform that we want, but we're going to defer to Parliament in the future the absolute minutiae and detail of what that body will look like. Now, this is not uncommon in Australia's constitutional history. When our constitution was passed in 1901, there are a number of provisions put into the Australian constitution that deferred to Parliament so that Parliament in the future would pass legislation to set up that body. So, the High Court of Australia or the Federal Judiciary, they're two examples of institutions that were put into the Constitution but not set up until much later. So what we did was adopt that kind of very common constitutional method of a decision to defer. And we also decided that, Parliament should lead the way in designing what the voice to Parliament will look like. Now, in addition to that, we are running dialogues in the same regions as we did the Uluru dialogues in order to elicit more information from communities on the ground about how they want the voice to Parliament to look. And that will be fed into the Joint Select Committee process. And that's a really important series of dialogues that's happening at the moment. We had one in Cairns with the North Queensland Land Council, for example, where we got really important on-the-ground nuanced information about the ways in which the Commonwealth and the state and the local government act and behave and relate to each other in that particular cultural footprint of North Queensland Land Council. So we're getting really, really important information about how the Federation works in relation to law and policy making across the country. And that will hopefully, enrich future discussions about what this voice to Parliament will look like.
So, as you say, the Joint Select Committee on Constitutional Recognition relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples is now assessing the statement, and you continue to feed into that. We know the Victorian Parliament is considering legislation to begin treaty negotiations, which could be seen as a bit of a sign that states are frustrated by the lack of progress in Canberra. But just quickly, in closing, where do you think we'll be another year from now?
People think of me as almost wholly a pessimist, but I'm still optimistic that we might see a referendum for a constitutionally enshrined voice to Parliament. I think the history of law reform shows you just don't shut up shop at the first sign or the first response that might be no. Law reform is not easy to get in this country, nor is constitutional amendment, but of course, one of the few successful constitutional changes in Australia was 1967, where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people worked with the rest of Australia to get that reform up. We've had such an overwhelming response to the Uluru Statement from the Heart from the Australians, and we deliberately issued it to Australians because we know that it is an era of law reform inertia, as you say, the states are frustrated. There is so much inertia, particularly in relation to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander law and policy at a Commonwealth level. So we're hoping that Australians will, as we say in the Uluru Statement, walk with us to campaign with us. The campaign, though, at this point, is to persuade politicians, our representatives, that this is the way to go. And I think that's the phase that we're moving into, as Marcia Langton said the other day, there's a real people's movement forming. The Voice to Parliament has polled four times now at 60 to 70%. Australians understand the very fair and logical reasoning behind why Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, as a kind of extreme minority in this country, as the first people, might want an enhanced role in the democratic life of the state. So we're very positive.
Megan, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, mate. Thank you.
Megan Davis, Cobble Cobble woman from Queensland, Pro-Vice-Chancellor Indigenous, Professor of Law at the University of New South Wales, and member of the Referendum Council.